Call the House Transportation Committee to order. It's 1:07 p.m. on April
Fourth.
Thank you very much. Oh, there it is. I see it on my sheet.
You want some glasses?
No, I'm good. Members present today are Representative Klayman, Representative Sullivan Leonard, Representative Drummond, Representative Newman, myself, Chair Wool, and we have a quorum to conduct business. Turn off your cell phones. That's been a real problem around here.
Not me.
No, it hasn't. Thank Heather Evoy and Summers Cole for staffing this meeting, as well as the committee staff, Laura Steidolf. And today we'll be hearing a presentation on hybrid airships by Craig Johnston of Lockheed Martin, their Skunk Works division. We still haven't heard where that name came from, although I think I read it somewhere.
I think we should require that, Mr. Chairman.
That'll be a requirement today of the origin of the word Skunk Works. And with that, I will turn the presentation over to Mr. Johnston.
Okay, thank you, Chairman Bull. It's part of Lockheed Martin. It's a pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be to Alaska. This is my first time. The earlier thing I mentioned that my wife was actually born in Alaska, but only through her infancy, and she was quite jealous that I got back here before she did. I would also note that you delivered wonderful weather, that when I left Southern California yesterday morning and got here to Juneau, it was the same temperature. So albeit it was our low and your high, but it was
beautiful weather.
it was nice, and I appreciate the ability to come out here. I would like to take just a few moments before I jump into hybrid airships to give you just a little bit of background about Lockheed Martin, not as an advertisement, but just kind of as a credential here, that the corporation is about 100 years old, a little over 100 years old. The primary component of that is the joining of the Lockheed Company and the Glenn L. Martin Company, which are two of the very earliest pioneers, but we picked up a couple of others along the way, but that's kind of the heritage. 100,000 employees. Largely doing scientific engineering and innovation sorts of technology. In every state in the nation, do we have product or people? So we're very proud of that. And in fact, in over 80 countries, can you find Lockheed Martin's footprint? Skunk Works, the division that I represent, has got almost 75 years worth of history, primarily in aviation innovation. Some of the products of Landmark are the introduction of the first jet fighter towards the end of World War II. So that was a Skunk Works product. Also worked with intelligence communities and agencies to develop some of the early spy plane technology, so the U-2 spy plane, the SR-71, and even some of the advances in combat capability represented by the F-117 stealth fighter. We also were the design agents for the YF-22 and the X-35, which are the frontline fighters today of our United States Air Force, and in the case of the F-35, the Marine Corps, Navy, and Air Force. We're very proud of the design capability that comes out of the Skunk Works. We have traditionally been motivated by solving very tough problems for the nation when they come to bear, and as I said, primarily been in the military realm, but of late we've expanded that to look at both the civil missions as well as the commercial missions. And so for the Skunk Works with the hybrid airship, this is a little bit of a back to the future, in that the last big commercial project that was part of the Lockheed Airplane Company was the L-1011 TriStar, which ceased production in the 80s. And so we're coming back now into the commercial world with the introduction of the hybrid airship. So we're excited about that. What I am here primarily to talk about today is hybrid airships in the transportation realm. Lockheed Martin considers itself a transportation company first and foremost. That's where our roots are, in carrying people and cargo and ultimately even elements into the far reaches of deep sea and deep space. But from a hybrid airship, it represents direct involvement in the cargo market space. It's been about a two-decade adventure, I'll say, that has been involved. On the first slide here, one of the things I'll also point out is that you see both Lockheed Martin and the Hybrid Enterprises logo. One of the things that Lockheed Martin decided about 2.5 years ago was that we are very good at doing things within the governmental sectors, but not so much in the commercial sector, and so we brought on board a partner that we've stood up called Hybrid Enterprises, and they are the worldwide exclusive resellers of the Lockheed Martin hybrid aircraft product space. So the easiest way I can describe that is they're the Ford dealership and I'm Ford Motor Company. And so they are the ones that you would go to actually buy the airships, but it's all in all, it's a Lockheed product behind that. So why airships? And I chose these two images really for the reason of if I had my choice, I would have turned it around to be ship air, but that doesn't work off as well as airship. And really what this entails is the fact that for centuries now we've known that the natural buoyancy of ships on the water allow you to hold cargo, and because you don't have to hold it up through other means, that it was relatively inexpensive to push it through the water. That in fact you can do it with sails, which are largely free in terms of the energy that does it. The challenge with ships is that they are relegated to the water, and so they have inherent limitations as to where they can operate. Introduced the concept many years ago of a hybrid, or not of a hybrid, but just of an airship that uses buoyant gas to lift it in the air. The advantage there is you've broken yourself away from being relegated to just operating on the water, but part of the challenge is how do you make that operable enough to actually take advantage of the fact that, yes, you're lifting some amount of weight through the buoyant gas, but how do you actually control it? And so if I could leave with nothing else, then when you think about airships, think about them ship first and air second, because much of the operation really has a stronger heritage to the fact that they're ship first and air later in terms of how they move through the surface. A short discussion on kind of the types of airships that are out there. The ones that, at least in Southern California, we're most familiar with are the non-rigid airships, also known as blimps. Those vehicles are filled with helium, and that is used to pressurize the envelope. Generally, they concentrate all the loads into one single structure that's hung below that one, so the propulsion system and the pilot and the very limited crews that are normally available all ride in there. Those are some of the oldest concepts that are available. Semi-rigid airships start to get a little bit larger and start to distribute loads into other parts of the structure. The one that I've shown here is actually the Norge airship of the 1920s. Interestingly, it's got a little bit of Alaska history to it, that it was an airship built by the Italians, flown out of Norway, I believe it was, with a design mission to overfly the North Pole and drop flags to declare we were the first here. So I read with some interest this morning that there was actually some controversy on whose flag was the largest when they dropped it over the North Pole. But the airship actually recovered into the Arctic region here in Alaska, had a not-so-successful landing, and they decided to just take it apart. And so I think in some of the museum here, you might be able to see actually some remnants of the Norge airship. But semi-rigid is another way of going after that.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
I read about an airship that also carried airplanes during World War
One.
Okay. And that would be a rigid, I guess, or... Do you know much about
traditionally those were the rigid airships, the Graf Zeppelins, that they would were large enough to where they could actually attach a piece of structure that would allow the airplane to actually tether to it. So they were used somewhat successfully. They were able to recover them on and off, but the utility ended up not being that high. But those were the large rigid airships of the 20s and 30s.
The first aircraft carrier.
Right, the first aircraft carriers. Importantly to note is the massive scale of those rigid airships. The one shown here is the Graf Zeppelin. Hindenburg was of that class. They were used aluminum structure that was then covered with a fabric impregnated surface to hold the hydrogen in at the time. But the vehicles were over 900 feet long. And so I'll tell you a little bit later about where modern technology takes us. And we're still contemplating large airships, but in a sense not as large as some of the great vehicles that were built in the 20s and 30s in terms of massive size of vehicles. But it's been since the mid-1800s that airships have been in operation. You've got before you some concepts for modern ways of going about it. I just have not included them here because I don't have the copyright ability to put them actually in a presentation under Lockheed's name, but you can go to the site noted and you can read more about them. But I'll just kind of walk you through the concepts. Both the Boeing and the Piasecki concepts were trying to capitalize on the fact that if I made the best of a helicopter and the best of an airship and combined those two together and used the helicopters to give me the precision as to how to move things around, and then the balloon to augment the lift so I can offset some of the weight that I would be able to come up with precision hybrid airships that were part helicopter, part blimp. The challenges in many cases, they turned out to be the worst of both cases, that they never actually went forward in terms of a viable concept because it ended up not really solving enough of the problem of, you know, what happens when you try and tie four large helicopters together and hang a large balloon above them. The Aeroscraft and the Varilift concepts are similar in concept. Both of those are semi-rigid to rigid airships, but they employ a very interesting concept, which is how do I control the buoyancy of the airship? One of the benefits and challenges of an airship is you can't turn the lift off. When you have a lighter-than-air gas, like helium, you can't turn the lift off. And so one of the mechanisms to handle that is if I just get rid of that helium by compressing it back in, making it a non-gas, I can control the amount of lift that I'm getting. And so both the Aeroscraft and the Varilift concepts employ a mechanism whereby they try and control their buoyancy by the compression and expansion of the helium gas.
Temperature.
It has some features that if it works, works out well, but it tends to be a fairly expensive way to think about operations. Ross Aero Systems is a Russian concept that not a lot has been portrayed on that one, but it does seem to try and bring on both rigid structures and some amount of aerodynamic lift. So from that standpoint, I think you'd call it a hybrid airship concept. Probably the most mature of the concepts and prototypes is the one out of the UK called Hybrid Air Vehicles. It was originally designed as part of a U.S. Army competition or U.S. Army contract for a surveillance platform designed to fly at 20,000 feet and stay there for a while. U.S. Army canceled the concept and the contract, but Hybrid Air Vehicles in the U.K. has continued to pick that up and tried to move that forward in terms of a platform that could be employed for future commercial use, whether it be cargo or surveillance or even sightseeing sorts of things. But that represents kind of the vastness of the concepts that are out there in terms of modern concepts for how to do hybrid or how to do other airships. So we're going to talk about
hybrid airships are heavier than air. While 80% of their total lift comes from buoyant helium, the remaining 20% comes from aerodynamic lift, generated by the innovative tri-lobe envelope design. By blending aerodynamic lift with buoyant lift, hybrid airships can achieve the operating efficiencies of traditional airships while retaining the reliable ground handling characteristics of fixed-wing aircraft.
So importantly, the hybrid lift, the big payoff is the fact that a portion of it comes from, 80% of it comes from the buoyant helium gas. And so that's as close as we can get to anti-gravity in terms of the ability to lift things. And so that's where a lot of the economics come in. But frequently with those economics come operational challenges. And so those are addressed by the two other components of lift. One is the aerodynamic lift that we employ by the forward motion of the airship and the wing-like shape that the airship has by its trilobe hull. That gives its operability on the ground and in flight. That one of the challenges of lighter-than-air vehicles in general is they are very sensitive to weight changes. With a hybrid airship, if you end up with an increase in the weight, say that you got water or something else that was rain that was on it, you simply increase the angle of attack slightly of the wing, of the body, and that will make up for the lift that otherwise would have been lost. So that gives you a component of very efficient lift plus robust lift. The direct lift provided by the helicopter-like operation also gives us a lot of the controllability. And so the fact that we have four propulsion systems that have a great degree of thrust vector capability gives us the ability to not only be highly maneuverable on the ground, but also in flight and in the presence of wind. So I'm sure I'll get some questions about how do these things work in the wind. But it's when you combine all three of those together that we get to what we call a hybrid lift solution. Specifically, the Lockheed Martin hybrid airship, the tri-lobe hull, that allows us to generate the aerodynamic lift. It also gives us a mechanism to provide a structural mechanism where we are able to carry fairly significant loads, about 47,000 pounds of load off that envelope by distributing the load across the entire surface. There are four thrust vectoring propulsion systems attached to the side of the vehicle. The envelope itself is non-rigid, so the rigidity comes simply from the helium gas that fills the envelope. So not only does the helium gas provide the buoyant lift gas, but it also provides the pressure gas that actually keeps the outer skin stiff so that you can actually attach things to the outer skin. Significant to the capability is the very capable fly-by-wire flight control system. The system makes it extremely easy to fly, but with modern computers and modern flight control technology, we're able to make all of that a simple mechanism for the pilot that's actually operating it. The fly-by-wire system actually has essentially two controls, one that says how fast you want to go from minus 3 knots to 70 knots, so you simply are setting your speed. The computer figures out what propulsion inputs I need to do, and then the other stick says go up, go down, turn to the left, turn to the right. And so it is very simple, very ship-like in terms of how you operate it, but very sophisticated in terms of the flight controls that are running behind it.
Two things. We're now joined by Representative Kopp. And also, so what you're saying is to control it, you don't have to know any particular knowledge about each engine and what they're doing and angles of surfaces. It's basically like a what kind of licensing do you need to fly it?
So we will work with the FAA that you will have a type certificate in a hybrid airship. We anticipate that what we will use initially is pilots that we are trained. Part of our requirement is we have to train what's called the initial cadre of pilots. But then after that, we anticipate the typical airship pilot in command would have similar pilot in command experience in a twin engine piston-powered aircraft, so it's not as sophisticated as the airliners, et cetera, because it is relatively straightforward to fly. But we have a requirement to work with the FAA for that training program and to train the initial cadre of pilots. But we don't see that as being a hard thing, because before these exist, there is nobody that's going to come ready equipped with 100 hours in a hybrid airship that we will train all the initial pilots actually in the operations. One other significant thing when it comes to the operability of hybrid airships or any airships is the ability to adapt to the environments. And so one of the challenges of some of the early airship operations was they had no idea what the weather was over the horizon. And so because of the relatively slow speed, a lot of times the Navy, who had a lot of experience with operating airships, would send the airships out without really knowing what was on the other side of the horizon. Modern weather prediction and planning allows that to be a thing of the past, that there's no place in the world that you can't go that you don't have probably a lot of ability to predict what the weather is, and certainly knowing what the weather is makes them very robust against events on the ground. A common misperception is that airships are more sensitive to the environments, winds, colds, et cetera, than airplanes. The answer is they are not. They essentially have the same weather limits as the current fixed-wing fleet, and certainly more robust than what the current helicopter fleet is. One of the things that's part of the operating profile of the airships, much like a ship, is that if you know that the bad weather is coming, you simply leave. So if you had a notice of, I expect 3 feet of wet snow, which could become a weight problem for the large surface area that's involved, you would simply say, okay, well, I'm going to put the airships into the air where they're less susceptible to that environment, because the snow, ice, et cetera, literally is blown off because you're traveling around at 60 knots. So it's hard to make stuff stick at that speed. So the onboard weather prediction and route planning is a key thing. It also allows for efficiency in that when you have an economic speed of about 60 knots, you can get into an environment where you say, okay, if I have a 60-knot headwind, I'm not going anywhere. Well, that's exactly right. But in most cases, in most areas where we've looked for route structure, you end up flying the currents just like you do in a sailing ship. So you would end up figuring out that instead of going just point A to B directly, if the wind's blowing directly against that, there's probably at the lower altitudes an ability to say, well, if I go a little bit off to the east, then I can actually pick up a tailwind. And in many of the worldwide routes that we've looked at, we can actually count on up to a 15-knot increase in our speed because we fly with the winds as opposed to into the winds. And so typically from a slight penalty to a slight benefit in terms of what's going on.
Representative Newman.
Mr. Chair, does temperature affect the lift at all? So can you use the same quantity of gas at the equator as you would at the North Pole?
So the answer is, if you had planned for operations in one spot only, you could optimize your helium load for that specific environment. However, there is on board an automatic system called a ballonet, which automatically regulates the pressure of the helium gas, because we're trying to keep that pressure constant.
Through temperature?
Through temperature, through altitude, through all sorts of things that will affect that. So as you go up in altitude, the pressure's going down as you change the temperature. So there's a built-in system called a ballonet, which automatically takes care of that. For most operations, we would just rely on the ballonet. If you had an operation that you knew was always going to be in a certain environment, you can slightly optimize the helium loadout, if you will, to make it more ideal for that specific location. But in the end, that's not a big swinger in terms of...
Is there any environments where they won't work?
No. There are environments where they don't work well, which there is one island nation called Greenland that has extremely high winds all the time in one area, and you probably wouldn't see airships in that region.
More because of wind instead
right.
of temperatures.
Yeah. Actually, as it gets colder, they actually work better as the airship component of it. The components that occupy the airship are standard aircraft components, and so those are generally certified by the FAA down to minus 40 C and F. So from a weatherability, if you can freeze any electronic component, but they're the standard aviation specifications for environmental specifications.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks.
Okay. One of the other pieces is the large cargo bay that we are purpose designed for cargo. And so our cargo bay is 10 feet by 10 feet by 60 feet long. Square, unpressurized. As I mentioned, we generally operate below 10,000 feet, which gives us nearly worldwide access. So there are a couple places above 10,000 feet where you'd have to specially craft the load to actually operate the airship above 10,000 feet. But that's relatively minor areas globally. The payload bay is square. The ramp of the thing is at truck bed height, so it makes for very simplified operations. We also have what we affectionately call the tailgate, which is a soft structure in the back that allows us to actually carry outsized cargo that would allow us to stick, for instance, a large turbine wind blade out the back of the airship and just simply leave the tailgate up and stick something out the back. Again, at 60 knots speed, you're not sensitive, and with unpressurized cargo, to some of the things that we'd normally think about from an airplane standpoint. Another feature of our airship is the fact that we have both cargo fuel and ballast tanks in the back. Normally, the ballast tanks are used for ground operations and think about pumping water on board. So we have to manage our weight state while we're on the ground. So if I take 44,000 pounds of cargo in, if I were to take all that weight out, the airship would lift off the ground. So I have to manage its weight on the ground, and we do that through a simple set of ballast tanks. So the first thing in any operation would be, as soon as you land, you bring a water truck up. It's typically 3,000 to 4,000 gallons. That's the size of a water truck that you might see at a construction site. It's not a large water tank. And immediately you would make the aircraft heavy. That ensures that it would stay on the ground.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. Through the chair, I apologize, but I had looked at the previous photo, and I noticed that there's a piece called the tri-lobed hull.
Right.
Could you talk just a little bit on that with the triple layers, per se? Is
Certainly.
That all throughout the structure, or is it just specific to the front of?
It's throughout the entire structure. So if you would, a normal airship is just purely round.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and all pressure vessels want to naturally go to round. What we've done is taken two rounds, cut them in half, so it's this, and joined the other part of essentially what would be a third one in the middle. So think one round, two half rounds.
Okay.
Okay. The reality is the round one in the center as soon as you put a load on it, what's going to happen is it's going to straighten out. And so if you were to look inside the airship, you would see two half lobes and then a lobe with straight lines. And what that ends up doing is that provides shape, but most importantly is those curtains that we call them actually become the thing that we hang all that load on. So the load is all hung from those two curtains. And so if you went back to that original hybrid lift, you saw the three-lobe hull. And so if you think about it, it's three what normally would be circles, but we've intersected them together to form that. And that goes from the nose all the way to the tail. And so that gives us a little bit of streamlining, but also gives us a mechanism for hanging the payload.
Just follow up real quickly. Well, when I first saw that, I was thinking of the double-hulled ships that that I know are required now for transport of oil and gas. And so I was thinking it would be kind of that same concept, but yours seems more aerodynamic or structural in design.
Right. So. Yeah, so it's not there for a safety feature to mm-hmm. provide, but it is three lobes, if you will, that have been put together for both aerodynamic and structural reasons.
Okay, thank you.
So in addition to the water ballast that we use to manage our heaviness on the ground, we also have a unique feature that's available, which is what we call the cargo fuel tank. So one of the challenges in transportation, in typical fixed-wing transportation, is you have a phenomenon which is called cubing out, which means normally when you haul things by air, you fill up the cargo bay with stuff before you hit the maximum weight, because we don't tend to carry really heavy stuff in fixed-wing aircraft. And so typically when you fly the fixed-wing, you end up not at maximum load. What we recognize is that not all cargo is really heavy, and so you might have an instance where if you're doing transportation to a remote village, maybe you're bringing on 10,000 pounds of groceries, which don't weigh much, but they take up a lot of volume. So think of a cereal box or something that doesn't weigh a whole bunch per cubic foot. So what do you do to make it maximum efficiency? Well, in this case, if I had 10,000 pounds of groceries, I would simply load those cargo fuel tanks with diesel fuel and fly out at maximum weight. So I'd bring on 36,000 pounds of diesel fuel at the same time. So one of the things that we recognize in remote areas is it almost always needs fuel. And so the ability to always fly full from a weight standpoint is very important, because it drives it economics. And in remote areas, it also drives the value proposition, which says even if I don't have a full cargo bay from a weight standpoint, I can make sure that I'm flying at maximum efficiency by always bringing forward fuel. And so importantly, their part is that because they are part of the certified system, it is not hazardous cargo, which allows you to actually fly people at the same time as you're flying that fuel. And so we are working with the FAA to our baseline configuration will be two pilots and eight passengers in the baseline configuration, but we can go up to 19 passengers. That's an FAA limit. According to security features, if you have more than 19 passengers, you have additional security requirements. But the people essentially fly for free, which is unlike most transportation things, is the ship is designed around the main cargo bay, and the people are there basically flying for free. So up to 19 passengers, non-revenue at this point in time, that we're not intending to be an airline, but eventually an operator could apply for an airline operating certificate, but at least initially with the FAA, until we establish a safety record, they would be essentially what we call non-revenue, which would mean, as an example, mine support people or oil and gas workers, sort of thing. To help kind of understand this, we did create a short video that is a full-scale mock-up in Palmdale, California, that was actually designed to represent a landing site in the Ambler region. So when we bring people to the what we call the hybrid experience, we say, welcome to Alaska. So we tried to put it directly in its working environment.
When you've got a big job, large equipment, people to support, and no roads to get there, there's only one solution. The safe, simple, and sustainable answer: the Lockheed Martin Hybrid Airship. Engineered to provide the most cost-effective solution, the rugged cargo bay transports massive loads, such as fully assembled heavy equipment. Hybrid Gilbert airships provide affordable transport and easy loading in areas not accessible by today's traditional methods. While performance, utility, and efficiency are key, so are the safety and comfort of the crew. For your most valuable cargo, the spacious cabin provides first-class accommodations for the long haul. The intuitive design and advanced flight controls will make your journey safe and comfortable. They say the road less traveled makes all the difference. But why not just leave the road behind? Hybrid Airships by Lockheed Martin. No roads, no problem.
So, upon looking at that again, I noticed that when they look out the window, they do see the...
Yeah, you see the envelope.
It's not all blue sky out there, so they see the envelope there.
So that was the concepts that we've been developing. 10 years ago, Lockheed Martin decided that the best way to prove to ourselves and others was to go ahead and actually build and fly one of these. And so the vehicle on the left that we call P-791 actually flew 10 years ago. It's what we call a subscale demonstrator. It's small. It's only 120 feet long, so it's a relative term. It occupies a fairly large spot in our hangar. But it was there to prove out the tri-lobe envelope design, that the aerodynamics work, that the digital flight control and the propulsion system, in fact, performed as expected. I can say that it actually overperformed, and so we made some design changes. And more importantly, probably, was the performance of the air cushion landing system. Palmdale, California, actually is one of the windier places on Earth. And so one of the things that we did in terms of the operation was to be able to prove that we could operate in routinely 30-plus knots of wind. The system is designed for 40 knots of wind, which exceeds most fixed-wing aircraft. And beyond that, as I pointed out, you'd take precautions that probably would say it's best just to launch the vehicle and get to the safety of being away from the ground. If I jump to the far right-hand side, that's actually where 20 years ago we started, which was a vehicle capable of carrying 500 tons or 1 million pounds of cargo as a over-the-air version of a container ship. And so we had high interest from large cargo players in terms of what would happen if I could take cargo from the middle of China to the middle of Africa and bypass all the modes of transportation in between. The problem is that that vehicle is very large. As you see, it's about 700 feet long, so that's about the size of the Rose Bowl stadium in California. And although large, I mentioned that the early Hindenburg and the big Zeppelins were actually 900 feet long. So as a civilization, we've built vehicles larger than that, but there are no real facilities today to do that. And so we've backed away from that insight vision, which we still have, to what we saw was an irresistible initial market space, which was in the small cargo market, the remote cargo transport market. And if you think that's the payloads that are designed to go on overland trucks or in C-130s or in the 737 fleet. So there's a ready-made market for that. It can be built in existing facilities and, quite frankly, has very compelling economics because you're competing against relatively inefficient ways of otherwise carrying cargo. And so that's the first vehicle that we intend to introduce to the market space. We anticipate having first flights in 2018. We will do about a one-year FAA certification program. We may actually bring it to Alaska for some of the environmental testings during that period as we prove that it actually works in the environments that are here. But that would introduce it into a commercial service in 2019, which is where we're currently planning that those first ones would be. So that would be FAA certified under a whole new type certificate. We had to create a new certificate, a new criteria for hybrid airships. And so we like to say that we've essentially written the tests that we have to take in 2018. And so we're excited about that.
Representative Kopp?
Yeah, thank you for the presentation. So as far as air traffic control of one of these ships, did you read US?
No, I was going
I'm sorry. But, I was thinking air traffic control. So this would have similar approach takeoff as what a helicopter would need? So if someone had a good big pad.
Big.
Right. Right. I mean, so I'm trying to think where you would commercially operate this out of.
Okay, so.
You would need somebody who has set up for that.
Our basic concept is that you would avoid the traditional airport.
Infrastructure.
Traditional airport infrastructure has long runways, lots of fast-moving things. So our fundamental concept of operation, although we can be compatible, it's not ideal to mix things that are flying at 60 knots with things that are approaching at 180 knots.
Right.
And so a typical landing area, not a runway, but a typical landing area is about 2,000 feet in length and about 800 feet in width. Is what our typical operating location would be. That doesn't have to be a runway. That just has to be something that's devoid of large trees because of the air cushion landing system. And so any place that you could have that footprint, and then most likely the most rigorous element that you have to accommodate is the fact that how you can do your cargo operations. And so I looked at the river over here and said, you could ideally operate on the river here for a landing area.
It's ocean, but it's close enough.
Ocean. Yeah. The ability to do the airship operations on it's fine, but whether you could move trucks in and on. So
sure.
You would avoid the traditional airport infrastructure. From a helipad standpoint, and I'll address it a little bit later, but you're talking about a 500-foot helipad if you want to do vertical operations. So at reduced payload weights, you can actually do vertical operations, not as precise as helicopters, so we don't have the same precision, but you're talking about a relatively large helipad that would be used.
So in rural Alaska, like a frozen river would be a
ideal.
The summer might be
even unfrozen river.
Even in the summer, you can
on water. Now, if you have a raging river, that wouldn't be ideal, but a lake would certainly work.
So, yes, I was just thinking if. Obviously, for resupplying and things like that, you would want a place where you could commercially base. So away from an airport, but obviously good road.
Close to rail is ideal. Close to a road network. Because, again, if you're bringing stuff from remote areas to the railhead, you want to have a quick mechanism to put it on the rail or put it on the truck. Because what you want to do is you want to transfer to the next most efficient mechanism as quickly as you can. That's where the economics
are.
So if I brought it direct from the remote area to a railhead somewhere that was not close to an airport necessarily would be an ideal situation. And so I know that one of our partners is looking at setting something up in the Kenai Peninsula in terms of a remote location that would be there. But you would probably not base it terribly close to existing airport infrastructure because it frankly doesn't need it, and it would be more of an interference with that.
I wonder if that's, through the chair.
Follow up.
If that's RL Logistics.
PRL Logistics.
PRL Logistics, right. Yeah. I know they have a commercial heliport there.
Right.
And a lot of logistical support for the oil companies. So.
Right.
Well, it's fascinating.
So I can publicly disclose that they are the logistics arm of the first announced interested buyer, which is Straight Line Aviation out of the United Kingdom. And they recently signed PRL Logistics as being a component of their logistics side of it. And Ron Hyde and I had a discussion Sunday and again Monday on the advancements that they're making in terms of their Kenai Peninsula development.
Something in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, my former neck.
Representative Klayman.
I'm curious, in contrast to the big airplanes and whatnot, what kind of price is one looking at for one of these? And a range, I know this is, can't be super specific, but is there a range that one looks at for an aircraft like this?
So there is a price, there is a purchase price, which is publicly disclosed as $40 million. So it's more expensive than used airplanes, but cheaper than new airplanes. And in the cargo market space, we compete with both. So in many cases, we're still competing against DC-3s that have a market value of about zero. What's more importantly,
we got some of those,
is the fact that it really competes on the overall operating costs. And so the price of the vehicle is a component of that. And one of the things that we're able to show through our detailed modeling is if I'm going to compete against used cargo aircraft, because that's where the typical market space comes, and not just EC3s, but widely across there, is by the time you roll in the maintenance costs, the operating costs, the fuel costs, the crew costs, all those other costs, and you roll it up, and you say, well, what does it cost me per hour or per ton mile to operate this? We're very competitive against almost all the existing remote transportation means. And so the purchase price is just a component of that, and that's a $40 million is the purchase price of the airship itself.
Follow up? And kind of unrelated to the price, but given the airspeed that they travel, you've got some practical limits on how far a distance you're trying to transport things. So if you had to go, say, 2,000 miles, that would be too far to use this to do the links. But if you're more in the, I guess, 200 to 300 or less, that becomes much more reasonable. Or am I missing something on
that? You're absolutely correct, sir. If you will, we have what we call economic ranges. The economic range is probably in the 300 to 500 to 600 mile range, and that has to do with the throughput of cargo, and how many flights do you get? How long is the crew on board? And so those become economic arguments that say how far it can go. I can tell you that we had a customer that looked specifically and said, can I take one of these all the way around the world? And the answer is yes, you can fly one of these 22,000 miles without refueling. The problem is it took them 28 days, so that's not an economic sort of thing. And so you note that we have a 1,400 nautical mile range. Think of that primarily as a ferry range. And so that if I had to deploy it from Alaska to east part of Canada, A, you would fly it there. You don't take the air out of it or anything like that. So you have a ferry range, which probably would be a non-revenue flight generally. It would be a positioning of it. But as you go slower, you can actually even exceed those sorts of ranges. But economically, the argument says that it's typically in the 300 to 600 mile sort of range. One of the things we're working with the FAA on is a new set of rules that makes it more ship-like in terms of how do you crew one of these things. So instead of having a pilot in command that can only sit in the seat for 8 hours and then you can't let him off, can I switch over and say, okay, instead I have a captain on board and he's relaxing in the back and I've got a duty officer. And so we're working with the FAA. That is actually the model that was there in the early days of the airships because they were same speed and flew for very long periods. And so it was very ship-like in terms of the crewing. The FAA is willing to work with us on those sorts of things, but those are some of the concepts that we do as we introduce this technology.
I think only one or two other follow-ups.
Sure, go ahead.
I take it flies lower, so it's kind of a different airspace than what the FAA currently regulates?
Still can be regulated, but we generally fly economically at 1,500 to 2,500 feet AGL, above ground level. The lower you fly, the more efficient you are, but your planning will be such that it will be weather-dependent and obstacle-dependent. You know, if you don't want to have to fly NAP to the Earth because it's not that maneuverable. So typically it flies there. You generally don't want to go to the maximum altitude, which is approximately 10,000 feet. And so you fly below much of the other aviation stuff.
Representative Drummond? Or do you have another question, Representative Clement?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is really interesting. Earlier you said you can take diesel fuel, for example, in the airship's tanks. Is there a limitation other than size and weight on the other types of cargo, say a tank of LNG or a tank of propane going to a remote village which would otherwise be difficult to reach?
So we have done some analysis on those sorts of things. One of our plans is that we will certify the airship to carry the diesel fuel in the tanks. And so that will be one that would allow you to, because it's certified, that you could have people and fuel on at the same time. We have looked at transport of LNG. It's not very well designed right now for airborne operation. In other words, the tank, the tare weight, if you will, of the tanks is fairly high. Mm-hmm. Because they're not, nobody would conceive of flying LNG in an airplane right now. Right. We believe that there is a market space that says you could do transport of LNG efficiently. It would probably involve a slight modification to the transport mechanism. Whether or not the FAA would allow us to do it as a non-hazardous operation, mm-hmm. is still a to be determined. So that would basically mean that you can't fly passengers and you'd have to take specific actions. But we do believe that this could open up a market that says, in addition to just heavy fuels, that you might actually even be able to conceive of a pace that you could actually deliver LNG to remote areas where you know, you start to unlock the sorts of things where you could provide a year-round access to that.
Follow up. Yeah, the upside is that a village is so small it doesn't need a really big LNG tank. So I'm sure that when we get to that point, and then the whole goal, of course, is to replace the diesel-fueled operations with cleaner fuel. So.
Yeah, and you would have the ability to actually, because the LNG doesn't have the same shelf life, if you will, of a heavy fuel. Mm-hmm. And so you could think of a periodicity that says, I don't have to bring in the massive tank, but I can just supply once a week. Right. You know, here comes the LNG, and I'm going to top off the tanks, sort of thing. So, yeah, we do believe that that's a potential. It's not in the baseline thinking because nobody's really trying to drive it, transport it by air.
Right, not yet.
Also, the other factor for LNG, as opposed to diesel, you don't have to worry about it spilling in the ground, where a lot of tank farms in rural Alaska have a lot of maintenance and rehab necessary. I have a question about your largest LMH-3, which is 700 feet with 500 tons payload. So the Hindenburg, you said, or Graf Zeppelin, was 900 feet. What did it have a huge payload like that, and or what was it primarily used for? I don't know
passenger
much about
carriage. What? Passenger carriage.
Okay.
So although it was 900 feet long, it had a payload capacity of about 10 tons. So about half of what we're doing on our small airship, and that's a lot to do with technology. That you have a rigid structure. You had fabric that was dope covered essentially, so it was not a lightweight, high strength fabric. And so we have come a long way. In terms of the technology since the 20s, but in terms of the massiveness of an airship, we're talking about something that's a lot smaller but much, much more capable because of the advancement in technology, and a lot of that has to do with the material.
Even though the gas was half the weight, all the other stuff was heavier. Right. And it was primarily like an ocean liner.
Yeah, it was an ocean liner.
Okay.
So it was never designed for cargo.
Yeah.
So here's the demonstrator that we built and flew in 2006. This is a ground operation, so although it's a fairly large machine, you can see how nimble it is on the ground turning on itself. That's afforded by the propulsion system, very kind of snappy in its takeoff and flight characteristics. If you ever have a chance to fly the simulator, it flies rather boring, actually, because everything is so large so you don't get much sense of motion, but it actually has the flight characteristics of a lot of smaller bush planes, as an example, in terms of its speed and rate of climb and those sorts of things. So it's very much bush pilot-like in terms of the remote operations, but at a scale that is much larger. So
does it get knocked around by air, like turbulence? It's not like...
No. You would get, maybe in real bad turbulence, you'd get a little bit of a ship-like swaying, but because, again, you have such large inertias, you would be very comfortable in it.
How much does it weigh? Well, let's say you're first, not this one, but your
LMH-1.
Thank you.
So weight is an interesting thing when you talk about airships, because if I take all the helium out of it, it weighs about 60,000 pounds. Okay, but when I put helium into it, it becomes very much lighter than that. So it's kind of a hard thing to say, how much does an airship weigh? Because I can make it weigh,
I guess,
nothing.
I was looking at dry weight.
if I take all the payload off, it'll actually weigh less than it'll float away. It's zero. So weight is kind of an interesting thing. So it's what we call heaviness. And heaviness is a measure of how much apparent weight you kind of have. And a typical airship, a blimp, if you will, typically has about 800 pounds of heaviness. So its weight that it feels, if you were to put it on a scale, would typically be about 800 pounds. If you would put one of ours on a scale in normal operations, it'd weigh about 20,000 pounds. Would be a typical weight, and so we have a robustness that we have.
I guess why I ask that is, as far as being pushed around by the wind, how inertia, I guess, is how much mass it would do.
Yeah, and so in flight, very little effect. And again, because the flight control system is saying, okay, I'm trying to drive at 20 degrees, it'll figure out. So it'll crab. It'll do whatever the flight controls has to do to make sure that it stays on the course that the pilot commanded it to. So whatever reactions it has. So we've known about this for at least 10 years, in many cases 20 years. So what has taken so long to get this to market? And really it comes down to understanding the value stream and making it clear across that entire value stream how this is good for everybody involved. And so I'll walk through this briefly, but in getting to market, one of the things that we had to convince was the players on the far left, the oil and gas and the mining, the extraction side of this, be able to say, okay, I'm a user of transportation. I need to move my stuff into and out of my facilities. How is this better for me? How does it save me money? How does it de-risk my programs? How does it end up lowering those costs? I'll give you a couple examples of exactly how we were able to do that. Then additionally, the oil and gas and mining folks don't generally operate any of their own equipment. They generally work through a logistics provider. So Pacific Rim Logistics is an example of that, that they connect the hard job with somebody that's willing to do the hard job. And so having to convince how does a logistics provider make money in this. Ultimately down to where we thought it would be easy, which was to go find the transportation providers. Think of the small airlines or the, some of the Alaska operators. So Linden Air is an example that operates in the transportation. How do you show them that they make money? How is this good for them? And then ultimately the financiers, which I'll kind of put Lockheed Martin into that, which says, okay, before I go do all the capital development that says, okay, I'm going to develop and field one of these systems, how do I know that somebody's actually going to use it or buy it? And so having to go through that entire stream of value and find everybody that's willing to sign up and say, yes, I can do this, that became a relatively hard challenge. And we've been very hard at that over the last 3 years now, and I can report on a few things specifically in terms of bringing this to market. But that's the hard part of revolutionary technology is how do you get everybody to sign on to it? That most of us wouldn't have picked up our cell phone today and say, you know, if I could just have a computer that I could, you know, hold in my hand and have Google Maps on, oh, wouldn't that be great? You had to kind of work into that. And that's a little bit what we're going through here. From a transportation, one of the immediate things you think about is how does this support offshore oil sorts of things. As it turns out, it has advantages in that it has the range and payload and cost advantage far superior to the helicopter fleets that do that today. But the challenge is how do I safely do those sorts of operations? That I mentioned the helipad that would be required is about a 500-foot helipad. And the last time I looked and we've looked at with the specific oil rig folks is even if you could find a place that you could put a 500-foot circle, you still have the challenge that you've got sharp things and fiery things and all these sorts of things. So landing on the rig itself is not necessarily an ideal situation for offshore support. We've also looked at, well, you can land on the surface around it and then transport crew to the rig. The problem is that's not without some safety challenges also, that putting people down on the water is not always a good thing. And it also depends on the location. That we've found a couple areas that you can have calm enough areas that you can actually think about the offshore support, transportation support from that solution. But we don't naturally tend to go for offshore things. In terms of the transportation support and the oil and gas things, it can support in multiple areas, in the phases from exploration all the way up through production. In the exploration phase, think about small, quick ways of moving, the ability to serve for long endurance so you can persist for fairly long on a tank of gas. The environment that the airship provides is inherently very stable. It's slow and without vibration, so some interesting aerial survey sorts of things, whether you're looking for ground mapping radars or those sorts of things, or the ability to do emergency services from. In a development phase, one of the things is we've talked with the oil companies about making their rigs small enough to where they could actually fit 20 tons at a time, and they say, yeah, we can do that if it makes enough sense. So actually being able to move the rigs themselves from both exploration and the development phase, but also pipeline. And, you know, how do you move the pipe forward to a central staging area and then maybe move it the last mile by some other means that you don't always want to clear enough space for an airship to deliver it to the last mile, but you might bring it very close and then helicopter it or truck it the last little bit. So it's very efficient in supporting pipeline construction. When you get to production phase, it's very hard to compete in the transportation of a pipeline. And so we don't look at a lot of oil and gas moving out actually through the airship, but if you think about it as transport and resupply of the production facilities more importantly, a lot of interest in spill response. That if you get to a point where, you know, how do I deploy to respond to an oil response spill? So is a key component for the areas. Ultimately, if you look at it from an economic standpoint, you guys probably understand transportation in remote areas, but all the challenges that you have down the middle. But if you look specifically, you know, we can push out close to twice the range of the current fleets, four times the load, and still being able to charge rates that are very aggressive, but still allow the operator ultimately to make money. So when it comes down to everybody understanding value in this, you see that we offer the opportunity to open up a tremendous new value proposition for all those players. Specifically, one of the things that I can bring out, this was publicly announced back in November, but there is Quest Rare Earth Minerals sitting on the largest rare earth mineral deposit outside of China. It happens to be on the border of Quebec and Labrador over in northeast Canada. Their plan was to build a road, a permanent road, from the Strange Lake project in the center of this diagram over to the coast on the east side. They have been working for multiple years to get the environmental impacts covered to do that, and we're having a challenge closing the business case on this. They were approached by Straight Line Aviation about actually creating a roadless mine, and so their current planning is that they're going to fly the rare earth mineral concentrate out of Strange Lake, about 120 kilometers to Schefferville, put it on the rail, and then ship it down to processing further. And so this is the first adoption of truly the roadless mine that others have been reluctant to sign up to. I say roadless. They will likely end up with some of temporary roads that they would build, maybe ice roads for some of the initial construction, but they're in the detailed planning right now of how they move all the stuff up there, including some of the infrastructure to provide wind energy for the region. So significant to that value stream is the fact that now you've got a mining operation that is signed up to say, okay, I'm ready to spend $850 million over a 10-year period to write the contracts that allow the logistics provider to buy services from the airline, flying airships from Lockheed Martin, so the whole string closes through there. Closer here, we look at Arctic operations out of Point Thompson. If you look at the budget that was allocated for the 2015-16 for this specific operation, it involves trucks moving up the Dalton Highway and then an ice road essentially for the last mile, if you will, from Dead Horse over to Point Thompson, and then still flying all the people from Anchorage to Point Thompson. If you only took on the piece that's that last tactical mile, the small hybrid airship would have resulted in a 25% reduction in the operating cost of that operation. So if they existed at the time, this particular operator said, well, there's no brainer I would do that because there's no reason I wouldn't want to take a 25% reduction in the cost of moving for that last bit of space. More significant is a major project that's completed in Papua New Guinea doing LNG movement. This one was a case where we were actually able to go in and look in detail at the costs that were involved, both the way they did it and how those costs would have been impacted if we'd done it a different way using airships. The total actual project cost was almost $1 billion, and that was largely to build the road and the runway infrastructure to allow the cargo to move in on a large Russian Antonov 124 vehicle. If they had had the 20-ton hybrid airship, they would have been able to do the same project in terms of the infrastructure set up for 98% reduction in that, so an order of magnitude reduction. That gets people's attention. The challenge is that no large oil company is willing to bet $1 billion-plus development program on something that doesn't exist yet. So one of the important things is that we got to get it to market, and you'll start to see that this will enable different projects. In a similar region, they are looking at transportation options that currently represent barges up rivers. The problem is there are times of year where those rivers are dry, unlike here where times when they're frozen, but there they dry up, and so they end up with tremendous risk of I could end up with a project that has lost all transportation options. And so they look at ways of de-risking those operations by bringing on alternate mechanisms of transporting people and materials up there. In the direct costs of transportation, if you compare the large Antonov 124 moving essentially the same stuff with a hybrid airship, you can see that we can offer a 72% cost reduction over the current way of doing it. So again, a thing that gets people's attention when you're looking at transportation costs. Safety is a key component of any operation. So one of the things about airships is they inherently do things at slow speeds. So from an airport operating standpoint, the beauty is if it really looks hairy and it's scary in terms of your approach, one of the things you can do is, depending on what state you're in, you could pull it back and say, well, let's just stop and wait here, because it can actually fly at zero speed at certain weight cases. Redundant systems, that's not only the electronics and avionics on board, but also the propulsion system. And our ship is designed to be able to fly with engines out. And in fact, it's one of the few aviation assets that if you were at the remote site and were to lose an engine, that you could actually take off and return home with only three engines. In most every operation that we're aware of, if you lose an engine at a remote site, one of the things you have to do is you have to take an engine forward and fix it. We actually have sufficient redundancy to where we could fly back on three engines. The ability to operate off any surface gives you a tremendous amount of emergency landing spots, whether it's a river or lake, an open spot that drives towards safety. And then also the fact that we're purpose designed for cargo, we keep the potential sources of fire away from people through separation. So those are inherently safety elements. Becoming more and more of an issue worldwide is the sustainability of transportation solutions. And so conservatively, on the fuel side, on the left side, that we're one-fifth to one-tenth of the fuel requirement to carry the same payload via an airship compared to a helicopter. Even compared to the most efficient fixed-wing aircraft, we're easily one-third to, again, one-tenth of the fuel requirement to move the same level of cargo at distance. More and more an issue in both urban areas, but also that we're aware of in remote areas, is the noise impact that you make and its impact on the environment and animals, et cetera. The baseline noise profile of a hybrid airship is about 60-some dB, which is about the level of noise that you would have in your average restaurant. So a relatively very low noise footprint compared to the current way of doing it, which is about eight times that level. So one of the things that we've looked at is its impact on the environment from a noise standpoint. Europe becoming hugely restrictive in terms of airport operating noise, so even in Europe we're starting to see people that are willing to adopt hybrid airship technologies. And then lastly, the emissions, the carbon footprint. It goes almost hand in hand with fuel. When you burn less fuel, you produce less carbon footprint, and so that becomes a bigger and bigger thing as certainly as some nations drive towards reducing that carbon footprint. So kind of summary, we believe purpose-built for remote operations and, in fact, ideally suited. A lot of that comes from the ability to operate without the infrastructure. So you don't want to have to build the airports. You don't want to have to build all the landing strips to be able to access the remote areas. Environmentally friendly, both from its emissions, noise, and infrastructure, the ability to operate without building runways, without building roads is very important. From a value stream, to be able to show the dramatic reduction in the cost of doing all those operations is key. And then lastly, that when you start to introduce these into thinking, we've had other operators that come in and go, well, I would do it completely different if I had this. And so you actually start to enable different concepts. One of those that I'll bring up a little bit is, we talked a little bit about the U.S. government. One of the things that is completely different in terms of its operation is some of the humanitarian missions. One of the partners that we've got signed up is a radiological group called RADAID that is trying to provide radiological services worldwide in rural areas that we are privileged to recognize how much we have ready access to that sort of service. But if you get just a little bit inland of most places, they've never seen or heard of an X-ray. And so the ability to actually transport a mobile radiological unit into areas without any infrastructure is one of those things that actually enables projects that we would never think about. And so we're very excited about those. And then lastly, with the plan that we're currently believe we're going to be executing, we could see airships as early as 2019 here in Alaska that anticipate flying and starting our certification program in 2018, and we believe that Alaska is ideally suited for the operations that this vehicle has been purposely built to solve. So with that, Chairman, I'll conclude my formal remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any further questions from the committee? I guess the intriguing part for me and maybe others on this committee is that the last part you just said, and Alaska's, well, earlier you'd said that lower 48 with its access to roads and railways probably isn't a likely place to see a lot of hybrid airship cargo activity, but Alaska being remote and without those kind of infrastructures, it would be. Also, where American state.
Right.
So if you guys want to test somewhere that's, you know, on your home turf, this would be a logical place to do it. And it sounds like you have customers and people very interested. So that's the part that interests me is, and I didn't know that prior to you coming here, that, you know, I've read about airships and Lockheed Martin working on it and Skunk Works and other people too. And maybe you addressed this in one of the presentations today. I can't remember now. But, you know, we've been reading about this for decades. Why isn't it here? Why isn't it here? But what you're saying, I guess, right now is it's here, it's coming. We'll see you next year. And, right. And that's a pretty accurate statement, I guess, right?
We believe so. That we, I'd like to say that it's done, but I can tell you that there is a lot of stuff going on in the background that is aligning all those component pieces to be able right. to say, yay, verily, we're able to do this. That I can tell you my company wouldn't waste my time to come up here and say that, you know, oh, yeah, it's just wait another year. Just wait another year.
Yeah.
We're serious about this. We've got a lot of serious players.
Right.
They're doing a lot of serious work trying to figure out how to really unlock this because it is truly going to open up new frontiers in terms of transportation right. in Alaska, in Canada, in remote areas. Ultimately, we believe worldwide as we deploy the full family of these capabilities. But
right.
starting here in Alaska, starting here in remote
yeah,
areas.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the timing was fortunate because someone had mentioned it to me in passing, and I said, I'll look into it, and we contacted you, and now you're here, which I guess is, like you say, testament to the fact that you guys are serious about being here. And, you know, we have transportation needs up here in Alaska, and we have resources and that are in remote places, and we'd love to combine those two right. things. And yeah, I want to be around when you fly one around up here. So I think that'd be exciting. So you know, maybe testing next year and see how it works at 40 below and in Barrow or well, Fairbanks. Yep, sure, I'll be there. So anyhow, it's very exciting. So okay. thank you very much for coming up here, yeah. and thanks for seeing so many people in such a short time.
You're welcome. It's a privilege to address the committee. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. And with that, I think we're about ready to adjourn. On Thursday, we'll be hearing HB 204, Overtaking and Passing DOT Vehicles, sponsored by Representative Kawasaki. And I will adjourn this meeting at 2:15, and thank you.